Welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast. I'm your host, Agnes Knowles. This time of life brings a lot of financial decisions, be they for our own future or what happens to our assets when we leave this world. For this reason, I speak relatively regularly to guests in the financial world. Today's guest has a lot of knowledge around trusts and being smart with our income in order to pay only our fair share of taxes. I don't recall other guests getting into detail about trusts. His info is American, so if you're other than, listen in, and then you know what questions to ask your financial advisor when you consider these subjects for yourself. I like having financial planners, financial advisors on from time to time. Because this age holds some of the biggest decision making we have in our lives. Can I afford to give up the 9 to 5 income? Can I maintain my current lifestyle plus travel, philanthropy? And what changes do I need to make to my will based on the above decisions? And I'm fine paying my fair share of taxes, but I don't want to get dinged unnecessarily. Finally, what if I outlive my money? Today's guest is American. I always clarify that fact as there are variations to this theme from country to country. But if Greg mentions something of interest, then it's worth checking out to see if there's something comparable in your country. Greg Kurenek, welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast.
Thank you, Agnes. I appreciate you having me here today.
No, this is going to be interesting. As I say, I love having you financial types on. Why retirement planning when there might be more money to be made with younger professionals?
The concept of retirement, I think, is still an ever-evolving situation. If we look back at our parents and our grandparents, they were all retiring in, mid-50s or so, early 60s. But even when I first got into business, I was only planning for 10 and 15 year retirements. Now I'm planning for 20 and 30 year retirements. So what you just mentioned, the fear of people running out of money is such a great fear. They fear running out of money more than they fear dying. So that's why they continue to work in some capacity. And now in the environment that we live in, with the more flexible work life, more Zoom meetings, remote work, things like that, it's allowed people to hang on a little bit longer than they would because they know they're going to be living for a longer period of time to try and stash away that extra money. So really, when it comes to retirement, so much of it has to do with money. Obviously, money is what drives a train and it's important, but it's really a mindset. It's getting your mind prepared to what is going to be this next phase of my life. Because when I'm working with clients, I think it's important to note that, everybody's definition of a successful retirement is going to be completely different. Okay. In my opinion, okay, and this is only my opinion, a successful retirement isn't sitting on the Burka Lounger all day watching Judge Judy. Okay. We want to be active and get out and do all the things that we haven't been able to do for the last 30 or 40 years because we've been tethered to our desk working. So, how do we go about doing that? And then those things that we want to do are all going to cost different amounts of money. If you're somebody that wants to travel or golf or do things like that, that's going to take some more money than somebody that wants to volunteer in the local community and just give back that way. So people have different perspectives. So that's why they continue to work because they never think they're going to have enough. But I tell people, when they ask me, am I ready to retire? I tell them, you have to tell me because it's a mindset. And they say, well, when would I know? I go, you'll know. And it's a different feeling from waking up on Monday morning and thinking, oh, I really don't want to go to work. It's almost a feeling of relief where you wake up and you're like, okay, I think I'm ready to do this. I'm ready to pull that ripcord and let's try this retirement thing out.
Right. One of your talking points is how to generate income in retirement. And I wanted to start there as I was curious if your clients need extra income to make ends meet, or if they choose to earn to afford their extracurriculars, like you just mentioned, or do they earn to bulk out their children's inheritances? as I was writing my notes, it was like the reason after reason why people might want to keep on working.
All those reasons why they would want to continue to work. Now, again, like I mentioned, the definition of retirement has changed so much. Maybe you were fortunate enough to work either in the same career or even more unlikely these days for the same company for 30 years. And you just want to change the pace. You're not really to not ready to completely disconnect. Believe it or not, this is still our identity. Our identity is tied up in work. So instead of putting in the 9 to 5, 40 hours a week, a little extra time on the weekends, maybe we're taking a step back and we're doing some phased retirement because we still do like that income coming in. Okay. But now it'll allow us to do some things. I'm only working 3 days a week. So those couple days a week, I can help out my kids and babysit the grandkids, or I can take some trips with my spouse, or I can join the golf league that I've always wanted to do, like things like that. But I'm still connected to work and I have money coming in, so I can pay for all of those things without dipping into my longer term savings.
I'm going to go off just on, into left field here for a second. I've always maintained that companies should really look at like a job share for the last couple of years of an older person's life because they've got so much knowledge in their head. As you say, if they've been with that company for 20, 30 years, and if they groom the next person, the younger person for that job, then you don't have that knowledge gap as the younger person steps into to the shoes that you've left.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, I think that can go both ways. Not only are we grooming the next generation to come in and fill your role, I really truly believe in the reverse mentorship concept where that younger generation can then help you to transition out. It'll give you some sense of accomplishment that, hey, I can get this person on the right track. And then they can help you put your mind at ease that, okay, I'm not just abandoning this company. They are going to be in good shape. This person is more than capable to do it. And if they're not, then you can go to the company right away and tell them that they're not, and then still feel like you have that intimate connection with your job, with the workforce.
Right. Now, I'm almost 70. I'm pretty fit and healthy. I know I have peers who struggle with mobility, health, and the thought of continuing on with work is overwhelming. Are there options for them?
Well, you know, everybody's career is different. You know, when I'm doing speaking to people, we talk about how, you know, somebody that works in construction or the trades, carpenter, a bricklayer, a laborer, they are going to be physically unable to do their job at some point. Okay. Their body is broken down after so long. As much as you want to say you're in shape, it just starts to break down on us. And we know that that's going to be almost a forced retirement because you just can't do it the way that you did it before, you know. But for those of us, you know, the financial advisors of the world, where all I do is sit at a desk and have Zoom meetings with people, yeah, so I could probably stand to work, you know, several more years because it's not physically demanding on me. So again, trying to figure out those job sharing opportunities where we can reduce the amount of output that we need to put out so that we can conserve what's in our bodies. But what I also want to say is, hey, if you feel like you're already starting to break down and you do have the funds, then maybe now is the time to retire so that you don't work until the day that you can't do anything anymore. And then you miss out on all those plans that you might have had, you know, the traveling, the things that do take a little bit of health to be able to do.
Yeah, I can see too. And we've all heard the stories of, the, as you say, especially the heavy labor kind of jobs. And they literally drop dead like 2 months before retirement and things like that. Yeah, it's just, you got to have some fun. So,
Terrible. Yeah. I mean, that's not a life for anybody.
yeah, that's a
Yeah.
whole big subject, but I'm going to go somewhere primarily because I'm personally curious. You talk about trusts, and I might be proving my ignorance by my verbiage. Recently, an elderly client of mine mentioned trusts, maybe for each of his four kids. I don't know. Can you explain trusts? And you say living trusts. What happens to them after the elder dies? And some of this is probably comparable country to country.
Sure. Yeah. You know, so I can speak from how it operates in the US, and I would assume that it's pretty similar in Canada and other countries as well. But you know, when people used to hear the term trust, they would always say, "Well, I'm not rich enough. I don't have enough money to do to need a trust." We think of trust fund babies and the wealthy and things like that. And that's not the case. The way that we are using trust with our clients is we're using it as a way to one, first and foremost, organize our financial affairs. Make sure that everything is properly laid out so that our estate gets distributed exactly the way that we want to after we've passed away. We also want to have it, the trust operate so that if we can no longer operate under our own, we have become incapacitated, whether it's physically or mentally, and our physician deems that the case, that we have something in place that says, I appoint this person to care for me and take care of me while I need this care. Okay. So that's one the couple of reasons we use the trust. The big reason, especially here in the US, is probate avoidance. Now, each state in the US is different on what their probate limit is. So I'm going to assume that countries are different as well. But the way the probate process works is it basically it comes from the old English term to prove up. So it's almost like a lawsuit against yourself where you're taking everything that you own. Okay. And now we live in this social media world. So you take everything that you own, every piece of real estate, every asset you own, and you post it up on Facebook. And it's the opportunity for anybody in the public to come forward and say, hey, yeah, Greg passed away. And, you know, we started a business together 10 years ago and it didn't do well. And I put in $50,000 and Greg wasn't a good partner. So I want to get my $50,000 back. And they challenge your estate. So now your estate has a decision to make. Do we pay them the $50,000 just so they go away? Do we fight against them and try and tell them, no, you don't get anything? You know the risks involved. Or do we settle in some capacity? All of that discussion is going to require some sort of legal representation, which means it's all going to cost money. Okay. So, and all it does is drag out the process longer. So by using trust in the simplest form of trust, there's obviously more complex trust entities that you could venture into. But if we're just talking about the simplest revocable living trust, we're trying to get organization of financial affairs, probate avoidance, and to make sure that our final wishes are carried out the way that we want to.
So, yeah, I'm going to use you as an example because you did
Please do.
first. So that business partner of yours from however many years ago, if you have everything set up in trusts, that they have no way to come back on you then. Is that correct?
That's correct. From the standpoint, my estate is not a public process. And by using the trust, you avoid the publicity that you would have with probate. So when you have to enter probate in the United States, it's a very public process. You could go to any county's courthouse and look at all the different probate estates that are open. And there's lawyers that comb through those probate estates to try and make challenges or judgments against them for their clients. So I once received a letter in the mail. This was like 5 or 6 years ago, a letter in the mail from an attorney in Omaha, Nebraska. Now, Koenig is not a very popular name. Trust me, I've done the Google searches before. There's not many of us around there. But I got the letter from an attorney saying, there is a probate estate open over in Nebraska. Would you like me to file a claim against it to see if you receive anything from it? Well, me being what I like to think is an ethical and moral person, and because I'm in the business and understand it, just ignored the letter. But sure enough, if any other Koenig across the United States got the same letter, they could have responded back to the attorney and said, yeah, the attorney's offer was you don't pay me anything up front, but I will take a percentage of whatever you get. So for lack of a better term, and I don't want to speak ill of attorneys, but they're more of a, we've heard the term ambulance chaser before. They're a probate chaser. Okay. So they comb the open probates, do a little Google search for last names and things like that, and then they will reach out to you to see if you want to pursue it.
And for the less ethical Kurenek, it's found money, even if they give 50% to the lawyer.
Correct. Correct.
All I'm thinking is all
It's
those
tough.
letters that go into my spam folder that I'm a boat beneficiary.
Right?
No, I'm just joking.
Yeah, this isn't the Prince of Nigeria sending us an email saying he's been captured by pirates.
Oh, no, this is, another Knowles who died and
Yeah.
left me all those thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions sometimes. Oh, dear. Okay. I won't go down that road. Okay, so our audience is boomers. We sometimes still have parents alive if they've set up trusts because they have Greg Kuranek as a financial planner. When they die, what do we do? Like,
Well,
how does that come to us?
the trust will spell it out exactly. If it's a well-written, well-funded trust, it will spell out, okay, mom and dad have now passed away. Here is who is now the successor trustee. So here are the people that are going to make decisions. And that could be an individual, or that could be, two different people acting as co-trustees. And then it's up to them to read through the trust and say, okay, everybody will receive 100% distribution as soon as all final expenses, taxes have been paid. Okay. Now, there's nothing to say that we can't do partial distributions throughout if there's enough money in the estate to do so, but it's now up to those trustees to start to gather everything up. If mom and dad owned real estate, now we have to decide, well, are we going to sell the real estate? Are we going to sell the home? Or does one of the beneficiaries want the home? If so, how are they going to pay off the other beneficiaries? Things like that. So the trusts don't become so restrictive that we can't, a good trust shouldn't be so restrictive that we can't have some flexibility, but it should be pretty straightforward of exactly how mom and dad want their wishes, how they want everything distributed, and when they want to distribute it. So if we're boomers, okay, and mom and dad passed away, obviously as boomers, we're all of pretty sound mind, we're good decision-making process, things like that. But if boomers are starting to make their trusts and they have younger children, okay, maybe they're still in college or high school, you might be more restrictive on distributions. You don't want to give a 17 or an 18-year-old your entire estate up front, because what are they going to do? They're going to run off, take a trip, buy a car, do things like that. But as a boomer inheriting from the greatest generation, I'd like to assume that we're of sound mind and we'll make better decisions with our money so we don't have to be as restrictive on those distributions.
As I started to ask you about trusts, I was reminded of another situation that I heard about where the elder felt that, child one and child two, who were in their 40s or 50s, were responsible. Child three, meh, not so sure that they're responsible. So child three, of course, I take it, this is just hearsay, has restrictions and is very angry about that. What sort of restrictions could you put on a trust? I guess it would be similar to that 17-year-old. So much a month, or I don't know, you tell me.
Yeah, no, and that's the best part about trust is they are fully customizable. So in that example, child one and two could receive 100% distribution, and child three, whoever the trustee is, then can determine based on what's spelled out in the trust. So you could put an age restriction, okay, saying that you can only get X amount at this age, you get X amount at that age, and you get the remainder at, a further age if you want to. You can customize it any way that you want. However, the trustee also has the ability, I don't want to say to override, but to take care of child three in that scenario. So let's say child one was the trustee and that's their sibling. Okay. And the sibling wants to, maybe they've been living in an apartment and they want to buy a reasonable house. And child one, who is the trustee, agrees with it. They can go ahead and make a distribution to help that beneficiary buy a house if they felt it was in their need. Now, if they thought that, oh, if I gave them an extra distribution and they were just going to go gamble it away or something like that, that's where they can be restrictive. But it allows, they're in the trust, it spells out that you can give distributions based on health, education, maintenance, things like that to help the beneficiaries out over, above, and beyond what is spelled out as exact percentages at certain ages. Now, there's some instances where you have, let's say, a special needs beneficiary. Okay. And if a special needs beneficiary is receiving assistance from the government, typically they can't have assets in their name. Okay. If they have too much in assets in their name, they may put that benefit that they're receiving from the government at risk. So in that scenario, this trust would remain open in perpetuity. And again, the trustee would help to manage their sibling or that special needs beneficiary to give them extra money if they needed it to go buy shoes, clothing, go on a trip, things like that, but enough where it wouldn't put their benefits that they're receiving from the government at risk. So it's a way to kind of protect it, hold their share in place, and protect the benefits that they're receiving.
Okay. I'm going to play devil's advocate here, not with that special needs child who perhaps might not have the capacity to understand how to deal with a lot of money. But I guess I was thinking that, like if I give the person sitting on the street corner a $10 bill, I might want them to go buy a meal with that. But if they go to the liquor store and buy a gallon of cheap hooch, that is out of my control. Why should somebody who wants to go gambling for a year or fly off to Hawaii and, surf for 2 months or something, do we have the right as parents, once we're dead and gone, does it matter where the money goes? Like, as long as we're dead and gone.
It's your money. If you want to, that's where I think trust gives you control. It gives you control of the money while you're alive, but it also gives you control from the grave. So if you, that's what mom and dad want, that's what mom and dad want.
Okay.
Yeah. I tend to agree with you, because who's to say that the millionaire child one that inherits money from mom and dad, how come they're allowed to take mom and dad's money and go on an elaborate vacation? But child three that doesn't have any money and they just take the money and want to blow it on a vacation, why, what's the difference? Why is that different? I don't think it is, except that child one doesn't have has plenty to fall back on, and child three does not.
Well, as an elder, I'm just going to distribute everything, and if they do something stupid, I'll come back and haunt them. It'll be as simple as that. Oh, dear. Okay, what are the tax implications of trusts?
Well, with a revocable living trust, the tax implications depend on the assets that it hold. And obviously, there's going to be difference between America and Canada and other countries as well. In the US, we have what's called step up and basis. So generally, when we own real estate, we're not pay any capital gains tax or anything like that when we inherit it if it's set up properly. Same with our non-qualified or our after-tax investments. We'll also get step up in basis in there. Any pre-tax accounts that we have, there's still going to be income tax due on those accounts, okay? And that'll be the same everywhere. But when we're talking about the estate planning and using a trust, we're not necessarily trying to avoid taxes. We're trying to manage it. It's okay that we pay taxes, but I only want to pay my fair share. I don't want to pay for Joe Schmo up the block because he's avoiding taxes. I just want to pay my fair share that's reasonable.
Okay, so last question about trusts is, does is it the trustee who manages the trust?
Correct.
If they are managing a trust for someone else, so child one is managing the trust of child three, do they get paid out of that trust?
There is an ability to, there's language in the trust typically that says that they can receive reasonable compensation. When we're dealing with family, though, I kind of have this conversation with them. Do you really need to take, money from your brothers and sisters to manage it? Or you're taking money from yourself because you're ultimately a beneficiary of it as well? Wouldn't it just make sense to let's get this settled and get this operated the best way we know? Now, if you have expenses, mailing expenses or legal expenses or something like that, absolutely you should be reimbursed for that from the trust. But to charge a salary or an administration fee, yes, you can. It's legal, but that goes back to that moral and ethical decisions that I think we encounter from time to time.
But there's a good chance that if the administrator of the trust is a lawyer, for example, so not part of the family, an external person, they probably would be taking something.
Right, which is why when we're talking about trust with our families that we work with, we try not to go outside the family. Sure, you can get a legal You can get a lawyer, you can get a trust company to do that. But yes, those are expensive. So that's typically why we name somebody within the family to handle the affairs.
Okay, sorry, I keep on going into left field here, but I
That's
just
okay.
interviewed somebody on family estrangement. How often does that happen then, where a child three says, screw you, give me my money whenever you feel like it then, but just don't ever talk to me socially and don't expect me to show up at your house for Thanksgiving.
Yes, there's a line that I say all the time. Money makes people funny. Okay. Money has the ability to complicate situations. I was working with a family and the parents named all four of their children trustees. Now, this is something that I would never do. Any of the lawyers that I work with would never do, but this family named all four children as trustees. The three brothers all got along very well. But the fourth, the sister, did not get along well with the family at all. And because they were all co-trustees, it needed to be unanimous decisions. So it came down to the point where she would beat them into submission just to get, and they would agree just to get things moving forward. And it's tough. And yeah, in that family, they have not talked to that sister since.
Wow. So, in a situation like that, where let's just assume you have an odd number of children, can you put a little rider in there saying, yeah, like all five of them are trustees, but you only need like a th three of them to agree, like a majority agreement to get something done?
Majority, the lawyers don't like to do that. They like to try and keep it as simple as possible. These trusts don't have to be overly complicated. And I try to say that when I'm talking with families, we can make this as complicated or as Loctite as you want. And our minds naturally go to worst case scenarios. Okay. I had a family that has four children. And they were all going on a vacation together. They were all going on the same plane. So they were worried about tertiary beneficiaries because they were going with other family members. If the plane went down and crashed, I go, if you're all dead, what does it matter? But they were so spiteful that they didn't want certain family members to get any of their money that they had the lawyer put in tertiary beneficiaries to make sure that it doesn't go to particular people.
It
We can
sounds
try and extrapolate this as far as we want, but you can only control so much when it's said and done.
they need the same lawyer as the royal family, where the heir and the
Right?
next heir and the spare, they don't travel on the same plane just in case.
Exactly.
Oh dear. Okay, so I said one more question about trust and just asked you six. Let's go back to taxes. We want to pay our fair share, but how can we? And I realize that this is going to be American and we're going to have to do research in our own country. But what are some of the ways you suggest to just reduce the tax hit?
Well, one of the suggestions, and this might sound counterintuitive to your question, but bear with me for a second. To reduce the tax hit, when I'm looking at taxes, I'm looking at the life of a retirement or the lifespan of a client, not just necessarily that one single year that we're working in. So when I'm trying to reduce taxes, I'm trying to reduce for the next 20 or 30 years. So one of my examples or one of my suggestions might be taking more money from your investments than you actually currently need. Okay. So let's say you're a married couple and you need $50,000 to live off of, but I might encourage you to take maybe $100,000 or $150,000 because I want you to fill up some of these favorable tax brackets that we have right now. Because in America, believe it or not, the taxes have never been lower. Okay. So think if you were to do a poll on the street and you asked people, hey, do you think taxes are going to be higher or lower in the future? I bet you 99% of the people would say they're going to be higher, in which case I would say, good, I agree with you. Let's take some extra money out and either put it in some other account, recharacterize it in different forms, things like that. But get it out of these because the majority for boomers, the majority of their savings are in these pre-tax accounts. They're tax time bombs. So let's get that money out in favorable fashion now before we turn on any other sources of income or we have anything else coming in to muddy the waters and do that for over a period of time and be methodical about it over the next 5 or 10 years.
I keep on throwing these wrenches into our discussion. But okay, so I have decided that I'm going to quit the 9 to 5, but I'm going to come back as a contractor, which means I'm earning twice as much as I was before. If you're earning more, then are you taking less out of your investments so that you don't bump yourself up to a different tax bracket?
Yeah, essentially, if you're earning twice as much more, you shouldn't have to take anything out of your investments. And it does become more difficult to do that tax planning that we just discussed. But here's what I'd say, Agnes. That's a good problem to have. Okay. This is not a bad thing. Again, I say to this to clients, we want to pay our fair share of taxes, but if we're paying taxes, that means we're making money. That means we've done a good job. Okay, so let's pay our fair share. Let's try and work within the system. I'm not going to do any, underhanded things to try and avoid taxation, but let's play have a plan in place. And that's ultimately what it comes down to, is having a plan, not doing this willy-nilly. Let's create a plan. Now, the old saying that we plan, God laughs. Okay, we know that plan's going to change over time, so we have to be fluid. We have to say, we might have had the idea of we're going to do this tax planning for the next 5 years, but then you get the call from the former company, will you please come back to work? We're going to pay you double. All right, well, now we can't do that same tax planning because we're making too much money. We have to extend it out a little bit. So just making sure, doing your research, working with your advisor, whoever you get your advice from, and putting that plan in place.
Well, you've got your little sayings. I've got a saying too that I really wish I was in a tax bracket where I had to pay that much in taxes.
Right? It's not a bad problem.
Yeah, no, exactly. Now, I'm going to go now to Social Security, Medicare, because I know you talk about those. Now, in Canada, we can choose when we claim both our federal pension and our employer contributed pension. We have universal Medicare, but I understand it becomes free for people at 65 in the States.
No, Medicare only Part A is free. You have to pay a premium for Part B. And then typically people will also get a Medicare supplement and prescription drugs. So it's still actually pretty cost effective for somebody in retirement, as opposed to somebody that's, 64 years old and looking to get health insurance on their own. If they're already retired before Medicare kicks in, that can be like between $1,200 and $1,500 a month per person versus a 65-year-old when you get on Medicare, we're looking at maybe between $300 and $400 a month. So the cost is actually, it's a cost savings, and it's very good coverage if you set it up properly.
Okay, I just recently talked to somebody who said, so of course I did something at 65 so I could get Medicare or something. So I was just spent or putting that out a little bit, and obviously I went in the wrong direction. I know when I was figuring out a small pension that I was due to collect at age, actually it was earlier than 60, but that or 65, but they said we'll pay your extended medical and your extended dental or like a percentage of, and my thought was I'm only going to get older. So yeah, let's get that taken care of because to pay the full shot if something should happen, would be a much greater hit. What do you say to people about Social Security and Medicare?
Medicare. So when I'm working with people, 65 has almost become the retirement age, and it's not for what we used to. We used to think of 65 as Social Security age, but that's not necessarily the case anymore. It's 66 or 67 for people that are retiring now. But because of the healthcare system that we have and how unaffordable it is, if you were to try to get healthcare on your own outside of an employer, that's why I see people hanging on working until 65 until they can get to Medicare. Once they get on Medicare, the cost of it is pretty certain each year. It is going to go up each year as you get older, but it's still going to be cost effective for you. When it comes to Social Security, I don't want to say delaying Social Security is the appropriate strategy for everybody, because to speak in absolutes would be wrong. But the longer you can wait on Social Security and allow it to have that built-in growth through the deferred earnings credits, I think the better off you could be. So, and this ties into our tax planning as well. For each year, the earliest you can file for Social Security is at age 62. Each year that you file for Social Security before your full retirement age, which is either 66 or 67, somewhere in between there, your benefit is reduced 6.5% per year. Now, for each year that you delay your Social Security past that same full retirement age, your benefit increases by 8% per year. Now, I said, I'm a financial advisor. I work with investments. There are no investments that guarantee 8% per year right now. Okay. So instead of retiring at 65, getting our Medicare set up, now our health insurance is checked off, and then starting that Social Security as our primary source of income and supplementing it with our savings, maybe we could still retire at 65, but delay our Social Security as long as we can, if possible, till age 70, and use those 5 years, I call them gap years, between 65 and 70, to use that pre-tax money that we've saved for all these years. Because if I have no other sources of income, how much tax am I going to pay on that money? Versus if I had Social Security turned on, which is counts as income and it is taxed, a portion of it, and then bring in those retirement savings, my income is going to be substantially higher. So it's just a way to try and control the income stream and the income flow. Now, a lot of this is predicated on what your health is. If you are healthy, like you are, Agnes, you're healthy, you're fit, you want to be out there, you plan on living a long time, then delaying does make sense for you. If you are an unhealthy individual, maybe you were forced into retirement because you had a health event, and maybe delaying Social Security is not appropriate for you. Okay. So that's just kind of how we look at it. It's not a one size fit all. It's not how it used to be. You know, it's a smash and grab system. Get it as quickly as you can because you don't know if the Social Security system is going to be there or you don't know how long you're going to live. That's not the way to look at it anymore. Again, it takes some thought and planning, but getting those deferred earnings credits can be quite substantial. You know, seeing your benefit go up by 24%, almost 32% just by delaying it, depending on your age.
You're going to call me Miss Wrench pretty soon. I crunch the numbers because I'm a bit of a geek like that. And I looked at how much I was going to earn at age 65, what I was like, what the government was going to give me at age 65. I say give, but what they were going to give back to me at age 72. And then I extrapolated, is that the word I want, out. And the numbers, like if I could take the money at 65, and if I didn't need it, just put it into whether it's investments or whatever, even a bank account, at, you know, at like 0.0004%. I wouldn't be earning this, or like I wouldn't have as much money in my possession until well into my 80s. So for me, that's why I said, screw that noise. I'm going to take it now and, you know, give myself some freedom of movement. And what I don't need, I'll throw into, you know, put it in the mattress.
Well, and that's why I said a lot of it depends on health and family history and things like that. If you think you're going to live into your 90s, then you're better off delaying. If you don't think you're going to live into your 90s or your mid 80s, then claiming early makes sense for you.
So, I can live forever, and so far, so good.
Yeah. I mean, none of us have a crystal ball, right? We could all get hit by a bus walking out the door today. But we do have some available information just based on our own health history, our family history, and things like that to try and make the most educated decision. But again, if I'm planning with somebody in their 50s, at 50, we might say, yeah, we're delaying till age 70. But when they get to 60 or 65, that might have been our plan, but something could have happened in that 10 or 15 year period to adjust our thinking on Social Security as well.
Interesting what you just said there, because you've been peeking at my notes. I was going to ask, as a financial planner, what sort of questions do you ask clients to help you in your planning role? And then I was going to say, do questions differ if the client is 55 as opposed to 67? So what sort of questions do you ask?
Well, the questions don't necessarily change. The first question I always ask, okay, and I ask this question when I'm at a cocktail party or a barbecue, you know, because people will come up to me and they'll say, oh, you're a financial advisor, you know, I'm getting ready to retire. I don't go, well, where is your money invested? How much do you have? First question I always ask is, what are you going to do? Okay. Again, going back to the beginning of our conversation here today, what are you going to do in retirement to give yourself purpose? Okay. So those are the questions I start with, because what you want to do is going to drive how much money you need in retirement. Now, if what you want to do is going to be more than covered by your Social Security, maybe you get a small pension, then okay, let's go. Let's do it. Let's move forward. But it's really tough for people. And I've made it almost a New Year's resolution that I'm trying to avoid using travel as an example for retirement, because I've learned in my 18 years in the business, not everybody wants to travel in retirement. They are more than content staying at home, hanging out with grandkids, things like that. Not everybody has this big desire to travel the world or go on cruises or things like that. But depending on what you want to do in retirement, some things are going to cost more money than others, and that's just the nature of it. So if you're somebody that is going to have large expenditures, then we need to make sure that you have enough saved, or you've delayed Social Security long enough to handle that. All these different moving parts that come into play. So what do you want to do is always the first. What are your goals and objectives? Do you want to give money to kids? Are you charitably inclined? Do you want to bounce the check that we write to the funeral home because you've run out of money and you lived your life perfectly?
I read that book too.
Right. We've seen the bumper sticker, I'm spending my kids' inheritance. What exactly is it that you want to do? And then we're going to work towards those goals to make sure that we get you as close as we can to them. Chances are we're not going to be able to accomplish every single thing just because, and not because you run out of money, not because, any one reason, just because that's life. We don't get everything we want in life. We deserve it, but we don't get it. So, those are the types of things. I need to have a true understanding about you, the person, and what your outlook on life is for you, for your children, and what you want your legacy to be going forward.
Just on a personal note, when you're at that barbecue and somebody says, "Hey, you're a financial planner, can I ask you?" Do you ever say, "Sure"? And as soon as I explain that, can you're Dr. Jones, will you tell me what's going on with my knee?
If I don't want to talk with them, I tell them I'm an insurance agent, and then they run the other way.
Oh my goodness. Okay, yeah. You always have to have that answer for the
Trust
one you
me,
don't want to.
I've turned into a party trick more often than not. We'll just get talking. It's usually Social Security that everybody wants to talk about.
Okay, well, I'm going to go to your barbecue right now and admit that, well, first of all, my financial advisor will tell you that trying to get some of these concepts into my head is, I don't know, it's quite an adventure. But what haven't we talked about that people need to think about, especially now as they prepare for this next chapter?
I think I'm just going to stress again, having an idea of what you want to do in retirement. The money is important, okay? You can never save enough money, but having an idea of how you're going to spend your time, what is going to give you that purpose. You might say, hey, I'm retiring in May. I'm going to sit by the pool. I'm going to go fishing. I'm going to do all these things. And I say, that's great. Those are all great things to do in retirement, and you're going to enjoy them immensely. But I live in Chicago, you live in Canada. What happens come November, December, January? It's cold out. There's no fishing outside. There's no running outside. You could be the most active person. You could go to the gym every day, but that's only an hour, maybe 2 hours if you dilly-dally around. So what is going to be your purpose? Okay. Make sure that you discuss it with your spouse too, because when we take those marriage vows, I married you in sickness and health. I didn't marry you to go to every doctor's appointment or go to lunch with me every single day. You guys need to have your own identities on top of that. So it's important to create that new identity so you have an idea of what you want to do in retirement. And then plan, plan, plan. Have a plan in place. Saving is the first step to getting towards retirement, but you need to have a plan in place so you know the best way to withdraw from those savings. Plan for those taxes. Coordinate your retirement savings with Social Security. How do you implement Medicare? How do we get that estate planning in place so that your wishes get followed through both while you're alive and after you've passed away? So plan, plan, plan. I can't stress that enough.
And you just mentioned the spousal piece of that puzzle. Do you try to get both spouses in the room when these plans are being made? Because so often
100%.
one, I was going to say, well, oftentimes, and it, maybe not for our generation and younger, but certainly older generations, it was one or the other that did everything, knew everything, and the other person, if they are the surviving spouse, they were lost, they were hooped.
Yeah, and that's part of the planning process. That's still the case. I see it a lot where there's one dominant spouse that is taking the reins, but especially in the initial planning stages, I need everybody to be involved so they at least have a concept. And for nothing else, especially when I'm working with couples that have the dominant spouse, that the other spouse knows that if something does happen to them, they're not lost. They can come to me. I am their resource then because I know the plan. I'm intimately involved with the plan. I have their best interests at heart. You know, if I'm just working with one spouse and they've never met me before, how do they know to trust me? It doesn't matter if their husband or the wife trusted me. There still needs to be a connection. This is still a relationship business. It's not transactional. It's relationship. I want to work with families that I get to know over the years that we have a real connection.
How often do you keep in touch with your clients? I'm just thinking of the single client who is dealing with you, maybe not sharing all that information with children or next of kin, whoever they are. And if they die unexpectedly, shall we say, whoever's left is going like, oh my God, I know they've got money invested, but I don't have a clue where. How often do you sort of touch base with clients?
So I make it mandatory that we meet face-to-face. And when I say face-to-face, that can be via Zoom these days. But I try to do in person. I enjoy meeting people in person, shaking hands, giving hugs, things like that. At least twice a year. Okay. But I'm always on call. If you need me for anything else outside of those two times a year, then you can always reach me. But I'm touching base with people, you know, once a month, whether it just might be through my newsletter, it might be a birthday wish, it might be, hey, as you approach retirement, we're obviously going to meet more frequently to make sure that you're prepared for it. Ebbs and flows at a minimum two times a year, but I kind of let them dictate if they need or want more on top of that.
And is your business card under a magnet on the fridge, just to be safe?
That's what I say when I give them any material. Here, staple this. Tell your kid, you don't have to give your kids everything, but tell them where they can find it. Don't put it in a safety deposit box because they'll never be able to get in there. Put it in your fireproof safe at the house, but let them know where the key is so we don't have to call the locksmith to drill it out.
Well, except I did hear one very good piece of advice, and that was to have a desk near the front or near one of the doors, because then if the house ever catches fire, it's right there as you're running out of all your important documents are right there as you're running out of the house, which isn't bad advice, actually. So
that's not a terrible idea.
I'm quite close with one of my grandsons, and I've said to him, if anything happens to me, this is what you need to give your parents. And it's the folder and everything else, so with all the documents.
I had the exact same relationship with my grandmother. And it was like, Greg, you know where everything is. You get it and you get it over to your uncle when something happens. You got it, Graham.
There you go. May I ask you a personal question before we close?
Absolutely.
Jean's journey for hope.
Yes. So going back to that, nobody has a crystal ball. My mother passed away of colon cancer at the age of 56 in 2012. So in the summer of 2012, she was still living, and my sister decided to run a half marathon in Chicago to help raise money for the American Cancer Society. So we did a big fundraiser that year to help get her donations up. She was the leading donation gatherer for that year. And after that, my mother passed away that following fall in October of 2012. So we decided that this is something that we wanted to carry forward each and every year. So we did it for a 10-year period, but instead of donating the money to the American Cancer Society, we joke, and we wanted to be selfish. We wanted to see the exact person or the exact family that this money that was raised is going to impact. Again, I'm an in-person. I want to shake hands and give hugs and things like that. So I want to be able to do this fundraiser raise money for a good cause, and then give it to a family that's been affected by cancer, that's struggling. Either they're struggling to pay bills, they're struggling emotionally because of this traumatic situation that they're in. We did not put any restrictions on how they use the money. If they wanted to take the money and go on a vacation with their family, please do it. If you needed to pay bills, please do it. If you needed to pay for college education, please use it. But just know that there's an organization out there that's willing to help you and willing to put the time and the effort in to try and help those families. So that's what we did. We would pick a family each year that's been affected by cancer and have a big party, raise a bunch of money for it, and get some donations, and then help families out.
It's kind of cool because I just actually heard I listen to talk radio a lot, and they were talking to people who had been the recipients of organ donation and how they just loved meeting that family that gave them the gift of life. You know, so I can just see that meeting that person or those people that are giving you the gift of some sort of financial relief, like however they spend it, yeah, is pretty cool to be able to say thank you personally and give and get that hug.
And trust me, you know, it almost sounds cliche to say this, but we got just as much out of it as they did. The satisfaction, that we know that we had some small impact on a family, it drove us to keep doing it.
Do you ever find yourselves keeping in touch with any of those families, or is it one and done?
I know it's hard to see, but this is one of my families sent us a Christmas ornament. So yeah, we do still stay in touch with some of the families. You know, some of our recipients have passed away, unfortunately, but we try to stay close with the families as best that we can. You know, lives get in the way, kids grow up, things like that. But yeah, there are some of the families that we still do remain pretty close with.
Cool. And I'm sure your mother is smiling down on you.
I hope so. I hope so. You know, it was in her name. She obviously instilled, you know, our belief system and our values, and she's the one that pushed us to do it.
That's great. Great. Where do we find you on the World Wide Web? I think you're mostly on LinkedIn. Is that correct?
I am mostly on LinkedIn right now. I am in the process of a rebrand and launching a yet to be named new business and website. So that will be coming soon. But I am on LinkedIn at Gregory Koenig. Otherwise, people can email me at greg@gregkoenig.com.
Okay. And seeing as how we clarified the pronunciation at the very beginning, the link will be in the show notes. And it'll be on your page at our website. Listeners, if you have thoughts on today's show, please talk to us. Leave comments where you're listening, or if you're listening at the Boomer Woman's podcast at boomwithabang.com, scroll to the bottom of the page and talk to us there. What keeps you awake at night? Or what question did I not ask Greg? Ask it in the comments and I'll get you an answer. Leave stars and reviews where you can. He just nodded when I said that. That's a good thing. Leave stars and reviews where you can. They help us expand our reach. And share this episode. As I said in my intro, money matters so much as we make decisions around leaving the 9 to 5. Your friends are having similar concerns, and the more knowledge they can gain, the better. I also mentioned in my intro that Greg is an American. If something in this conversation today tweaked your curiosity, do some searches in your country. Many of us have similar systems, perhaps just under a different name. Greg Koenig, thank you for being my guest today and giving us so much to think about as we prepare for this next chapter.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Have a great rest of week.
You do the same.